You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 12th, 2006. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. With me tonight are Bob Novella.
Hello, everyone.
Rebecca Watson.
Hey there.
Perry DeAngelis.
Hey, everybody.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Welcome, everyone. How's everyone this evening?
Good, Steve.
Hi.
Good, Steve. Thanks.
Spring is in the air, you know?
Yeah, the weather is finally looking up in New England.
70 degrees today.
We have a brand new website about to debut, thanks to our webmaster, Jay. Jay, thanks for all the hard work you've done on the website. It's looking good.
Yay.
We have a new URL, theskepticsguide.org. We're keeping our old one as well, so all the old links will still work, but we're going to duplicate our site on our new URL. And we're making inroads. We've been on iTunes now for a while. We have a couple of good reviews on there. So if you listeners out there, if any of you get to The Skeptic's Guide through iTunes, first, thanks for signing up and listening. And if you can, take the time, tell us what you think about our podcast. Give us a friendly review on iTunes. Help get our profile up. We're number 68 as of today. I took a look at it, of the top 100 science podcasts on iTunes. We're up to 68. So we're at least on the radar. Also, we are listed with a lot of other podcast listing sites. If you find a podcast listing site that we're not on, please let us know so that we can get The Skeptic's Guide on there. A lot of those sites do have mechanisms by which you can vote for your favorite podcast, or you can rate our podcast or review them. So we ask for whatever help you can give us in getting the profile of our podcast up. I'd like to get more listeners. So, Rebecca, I was reading your blog, as I do every day, and you talked recently about Bill Nye the Science Guy getting into a little bit of controversy. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, you guys heard about this? I love Bill Nye, because you know who is sweeter and funnier, you know, and zanier than Bill Nye the Science Guy? He is the Mr. Wizard of the current generation. For those of you who don't know, he had a show on PBS, I think it was where it was running, where he does crazy science tricks with kids, and they used to show his videotapes like in school and stuff, when I was in school at least. And recently he was in Texas, I think last week, and he was giving a lecture at a community college, and he happened to mention that according to the Bible, God made two great lights. There was the greater light to govern the day, the lesser light to govern the night. And he told the audience that despite what the Bible says, actually the sun, as opposed to being just one of two great lights, is just one of billions of stars. And also the moon isn't a light at all, but it's actually lit up by the sun. So, you know, apparently some people in the audience didn't really like having the Bible pointed out as being inaccurate. And they kind of got up in a huff and left, and said on the way out, one woman yelled, "We believe in a God," which is just so random.
A non sequitur. Yeah.
Yeah, because apparently believing in a God, you know, you can't also believe in reality, according to this woman. So it's kind of funny.
You know, we've certainly been at conferences before where people have gotten up and walked out, haven't we, Steve?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's if you're doing your job, you know, you're going to offend somebody, basically.
Well, yeah, I mean, and if you're in Texas at a lecture and you're going to talk about how wrong the Bible is, you're probably looking for trouble, and I think you found it.
But, you know, I mean, I think it's okay to do that, to put our current scientific view of the world into historical context. Again, I think Carl Sagan did that very eloquently. He was the best person at doing that I've personally seen. So I don't know. I mean, I think you'd have to see exactly what Bill Nye said and how he said it. Was it a gratuitous slap at the Bible, or was it just sort of for historical context. This is what people used to, how they used to envision the universe, and now we discovered, you know, that the universe has a different structure, which I think is important. You know, how our ideas about the universe evolved over historical time is really important thing to know.
Oh yeah, totally. Especially because, you know, if you talk to Phil Plait, the bad astronomer at badastronomy.com, he talks a lot about how the creationists have kind of, they're shifting their focus onto other disciplines and they're attacking astronomy. So that's one of the things where we do have to kind of point out that, no, the Bible is not literally correct on this.
Well, it's not a scientific document. That's correct. The bottom line.
Why would someone who wouldn't want to hear what Bill Nye is saying and be into it even show up at his lecture?
Well, I think that it's just one of those things that in your head you're thinking, oh, it's fun, science, magic, you know, tricks, whatever. But then when it's pointed out that this actually goes against what the Bible said, it kind of flips a switch for them. They don't really think it through.
I think most probably they weren't thinking about anything before they went. I'm serious. TV, it's fame. It's a name they recognize.
Who knows?
His name rhymes. Yeah. That's enough.
Well, I don't know. I think that for a lot of people, though, you've got science and you've got religion, and they go in these parallel lines that don't cross, and they're okay with that. And then
people have no problem compartmentalizing their knowledge.
Right. Those two things bump into each other, and then boom, you know. Some people don't like thinking about those things, and it can be a little shocking when they first run into each other.
In fact, you can be a fairly sound skeptic and have a religious
or have some sacred cow. It doesn't have to be religious. Even skeptics, you know, religion is obviously a very common sacred cow, but I know skeptics who have pseudoscientific sacred cows. You know, they believe in some alternative medicine modality as almost with religious fervor. For example, I know some skeptics who believe in Eastern philosophy because it's, to them, it's not religion; it's just spirituality, or
something crazy like nanotechnology,
right, or cryogenics, or something like that.
Cryonics,
cryonics, whatever.
get it right, pal.
And I think that just goes to show you that skepticism, a skeptic isn't just a person. There's not some person you can just define a skeptic. It's just a way of thinking, and you know, some people apply it to everything. Some people can't.
It's a method, and people are imperfect, and we get it wrong.
Yeah,
you know,
quite right. Quite right.
Well, Tom Cruise is back in the news again. He's still on about his anti-psychiatry crusade. He's now warning people to think carefully before they take those bad drugs that the psychiatrists are giving them, and he also claims that he can get a heroin addict off of heroin in 3 days using the Scientology auditing methods.
Prove it.
Right. It's interesting, you know. You read the blogs in response to Cruz's, you know, latest outburst. One of them very deftly pointed out that, you know, Dianetics and auditing was L. Ron Hubbard's attempt at snake oil salesman. You know, this was just his quackery that he was trying to make a fast buck at. And the bottom line is it didn't work. And the AMA and, you know, legitimate medical institutions went after him for trying to sell snake oil. So he said, no, this isn't working out too well. You know, my methods don't work, and I'm running afoul of medicine. So let me turn it into a religion. That way I'll be safe from the scientific and medical establishments, and, you know, people will believe it because it's a religion. And that's exactly what he did. So Dianetics became Scientology. And here we go, whenever 50 years later, we have lunatics like Tom Cruise who believe in it. It's just really incredible.
Let's lock Tom in a room with 1,000 people on these drugs, take their drugs away, and leave him in there for a couple
of
months.
Yeah, see how he
does. Perry, you're glib.
Let's see how he makes out in there. Let's see how he makes out.
But I hear that he and Katie Holmes are preparing for their silent birth.
Aww.
You can't have any noise in the birthing room because
Steve,
it could cause trauma.
Bob and I were talking about this.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'll be more accurate. I was tripping out about this because, you know, every time I hear anything about this guy, I lose my mind. And Bob said something very, very intelligent. He said, which is rare for Bob, of course. Mm-hmm. He said, why don't they just say really nice things when the baby's born? Instead of being quiet, do the exact opposite of what they don't want, which is say nice, positive things.
Like life-affirming phrases.
Yeah, and that should do the, that should do, you know, because what are they saying? They shouldn't say anything and have all that anxiety and tension in the air by what people are saying.
Apparently, yeah, there's a window when you're being born where it just, you're, the baby just absorbs all this negative energy and these words and things. Well, if that's true and that could happen, then say things that could have a positive influence in their life instead of negative. You know, so yeah, if you got this opportunity, you know, take advantage of it.
Well, let's yeah, let's not give them any ideas. Yeah, you know, that'll be the next book, right?
Right.
So you guys know I'm a big fan of the chiropractic discipline, right?
Yeah.
I always love it when chiropractors embrace some other pseudoscience that has nothing to do with chiropractic or medicine. So again, this is another one, Rebecca, that you wrote about, this chiropractor who claims that he can heal people by going back in time and healing them in the past.
Now, I have no idea exactly how going back in time really heals you, because he talks about being able to go back in time and he talks about being able to heal random things that are wrong with you, aches and pains, things like that. But he never actually marries the two concepts, because you know, you don't really expect them to make sense, but
yeah,
I at least want a decent explanation.
Yeah, this guy definitely seemed certifiable. What his point seemed to be was that it's not so much going back in time. The other part of this article dealt with mainly him doing this distant healing. I mean, all it takes is a phone call. You don't have to go to his office. Just give him a buzz, and bam, he could heal you, you know, over the phone, kind of this distant healing. So, and that's what
he
the article
has a magic stressed word.
He has a magic word.
Yeah,
what's the word?
It's Balakim, I guess.
Balakim. Yeah.
Balakim.
Because you see, it's meaningful because it has no meaning, and it has a soothing vibrational influence and contains the very special number of 9 letters. So maybe while Katie Holmes is having her baby, she should just say Balakim over and over again.
There you go.
Are you saying ballet queen?
Now that would work too. Ballet queen.
Balakim.
Well, can he cure anything on the phone call?
He says, go to his website, pain relief anytime, anywhere with a vibrational adjustment or manipulation.
Oh, I know what he's talking about.
I don't think so. For yeah, $60,
okay,
bucks,
pain
$60
relief
he can cure you of anything over the internet, you know, with his vibrations.
Well, wait a minute now. Pain relief is not cure.
Yeah, no,
I know,
he
but
says...
But pain relief is a really good thing for quacks to treat because it's so subjective.
Right.
Steve, now what's this whole time travel thing? How does he do it? What's his machine, or what's he doing?
I think he just does it in his head.
Is it a Wayback Machine? The Peabody School?
It's all you know, just part of the sort of the woo woo philosophy that he couches his claims in.
Yeah, I don't think he has an actual machine or anything. Nothing that cool.
Oh,
I think it's
maybe
quite
he goes back in
head.
Time spiritually. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, something
I
like
think
that.
He has a DeLorean.
Maybe he's not.
He does.
He drives a DeLorean.
That means he's making bank. She's joking.
Back to the Future,
you guys,
Jay. Come
oh, God, are you kidding me? I totally missed that one.
Oh, my God. That was too easy. Hey, when are you eating all that bacon, Jay?
I'll eat it. You can get your hands on that specific bacon, and if it doesn't taste like fish, I will eat it.
I am going to track down the healthy bacon pig, and I am going to kill it myself.
We're waiting for the FDA on that.
Rebecca, listen. What yeah, person in their right mind wouldn't eat 10 pounds of healthy bacon?
Well, me, because I'm a vegetarian.
Don't get me started.
What sane person in their right mind wouldn't want to eat 10 pounds of healthy bacon?
Wait. In one sitting?
Wait a minute. You're a vegetarian?
Oh, I knew that would get one of you.
You're a vegetarian?
I'm the worst kind.
You're not a vegan?
The other way. I mean, I'm the worst kind in that I could, you know, see a piece of fish and say, oh, that looks kind of good. That's basically a vegetable, and I'll eat it.
Are you a vegetarian for health reasons or for animal rights reasons?
No, vegetarianism is my one weird quirk that I allow myself. It's the one thing that I don't. I just decide that I don't need to explain to people. And,
it's your sacred cow.
It's my sacred cow. I don't get upset over it.
Ironically,
people,
but yeah. Rebecca, Rebecca,
yes,
steak, steak.
Yeah, not that into it.
It's good.
Wait a minute. You're a vegetarian?
Now, Perry, denial is another episode. We'll cover denial.
But you know, I make one of the best cheesesteaks you've ever had in your life. I used to make Philly cheesesteaks for a living when I was in high school. So
You make no sense to me at all. You make no sense.
I know, I'm an enigma wrapped in a mystery or something.
Covered with cheese.
And sprinkles.
All right, let's move on. Perry, this one's for you. Climate of fear. Global warming alarmists intimidate dissenting scientists into silence.
George Will recently wrote about this.
It's a Wall Street Journal editorial written by Richard Lindzen, who is the Alfred P. Sloan Professor of Atmospheric Science at MIT. So this guy is a real scientist, an atmospheric scientist, so he probably knows what he's talking about. And what he's basically saying in his editorial is that climatologists or climate scientists who have a dissenting opinion from the notion that global warming is a real and coming threat are being intimidated either by drying up of their research funds or, you know, being threatened to lose their jobs by the institutions and the people who hire them, etc. So this is, I think, a very interesting debate that has been raging, you know, in the scientific community. It's a very interesting debate for skeptics because there is a very real scientific controversy at the core of this, but swirling around that is the interaction of politics and science. And it gets very complicated. And, you know, this makes it even more complicated when you have an MIT atmospheric scientist basically dissenting from the consensus opinion and also accusing the consensus of trying to intimidate the minority report, if you will. We had on our show months ago Steve Malloy, who is a fellow of the Cato Institute, who agrees with Richard Lindzen's position that global warming is bunk and it's basically the sacred cow, if you will, of environmentalists, and there's basically a big intimidation conspiracy against people who disagree with it.
And I personally lean in that direction.
And I lean very much in the other direction. I think that there is a scientific consensus that there is man-made global warming, that the consensus is based upon 50 years of disagreement, and they basically hammer... This is how the scientific process works. People have different points of view. They hammer out their disagreements. They do the tests. They do the studies to answer the questions and the challenges from the other side, and slowly you build a consensus over time. And I think that consensus has been built on very solid principles, on very solid evidence. So I think that at this point, we're pretty safe in saying that there is man-made global warming. What nobody could say, though, is what this means for the future. And I think that's where the anti-alarmists, if you will, you know, have their strongest criticisms. We don't know what the implications are for the planet that there is man-made global warming. Although there's a lot of reason, I think, to be concerned. Because and even though it may not change the climate for the objectively worse, meaning that the Earth... as far as the planet Earth is concerned, you know, a slight shift in the climate may not be a bad thing. But it may be a very bad thing for the economic institutions that we have set up on this world. If the breadbasket of America turns into a desert, the Earth doesn't care. You know, animals will habitat track. But, you know, we'll care if that happens. If sea levels rise a few inches, you know, again, the environment won't really care. But, you know, cities on the coastline will care.
But I mean, Stephen, when my ear hears things like the breadbasket of America is going to be a desert, I mean, it's
But Perry, that happens all the time over historical time. You know, the Sahara Desert was a lush forest at one point. Climates change.
Yeah, that's right. And they changed before we got here.
They do. And no one's saying that the climate we have today will and should be the way it is forever. But we don't, it probably is not in our best interest to hasten a change in our climate, because that could shift things. You know, we could, the current deserts could start to have more rainfall, and current areas that are currently very productive may become dry.
Well, look, Steve, I agree with your analysis that it's not going to have a great deal of impact on the globe, but it will certainly on our economic institutions and such like that, a change in the climate. So will an overabundance of regulation and unnecessary rules and things along these lines.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wrote about this in my Weird Science column, and I basically came to the conclusion that there is reason for concern on both sides. If unwarranted hysteria and overregulation will also hurt us economically and can have unforeseen consequences, but what we need are rational measures. I disagree with the Steve Malloy end of the spectrum, who are basically saying there's absolutely nothing to worry about. It may be a good thing for the Earth if we raise our temperature a couple of degrees, and that the scientific consensus is not legitimate. I disagree with that position. I think there is a legitimate scientific consensus that there is man-made global warming. I think that, the difficulty is in extrapolating the implications of that into the future, but most of the models have serious reason for concern in terms of melting ice caps, raising sea levels, shifting rainfalls, maybe the loss of what are currently productive areas for farming. So I think that common sense, reasonable measures not to systematically shift our environment or our climate in one direction, I think is reasonable.
Steve, I read something, and tell me if this information is true. I read that the polar ice caps are shrinking, and then they did a study from the 70s, and they tracked it all the way up, I think, till the year 2000, and it said, there was like a 20% decrease in the polar ice cap size, and that's raising
20%.
The average sea level.
The polar ice caps have not shrunk 20%.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do is, I read information and I'm trying to get a consensus, because I've read that and that's disturbing. If that's true, then if that happened in 20, 30 years, that's a problem.
Yeah, well, that is in fact true in terms of the melting back of glaciers and the polar ice caps. What we don't know is if this kind of shrinking and expansion just happens over historical time. We haven't been tracking it that carefully for long enough to really know that. So if you want to deny that man-made global warming is happening or is a problem, you could say this is just the natural fluctuation. This is just the trend,
Since 1970, 20%, one-fifth of the ice in the polar has melted. Forget about it. The oceans would rise a great deal.
It depends which pole you're talking about, north or south. The North Pole wouldn't affect the sea level because it's already floating, but the South
only
Pole
ice
would.
Only ice that's on land would actually raise the sea level. Ice that's floating won't raise the sea level because it's already floating.
So only one of the poles melted?
No, just the implication of that much ice is not as severe as you might think to ocean levels, because it only that portion of ice which is melting off of land into the oceans affects the sea level. Ice, like icebergs, when they melt, the water they melt into exactly fills the space that the ice occupied, because the iceberg displaces its weight in water. When it melts into water, there's zero change in the sea level. So anyway, I don't know off the top of my head if the 20% figure is accurate. I could check on that. But
yeah, so
every week, there are new reports of the global warming trend. So there seems that there's multiple independent lines of evidence that are going in the same direction. But because sincere and good scientists can disagree on this issue, I think sincere and good skeptics can disagree on this issue. That's what makes it interesting to me. Most of the time, we're all on the same page, right? We all think that Bigfoot is bunk, and there are no aliens visiting the Earth, and et cetera. But it's good to have an issue that we can disagree on.
Wait, Bigfoot is genuine bunk? When did this happen?
Oh, yeah.
Crap.
Well,
sorry,
Steve, what's troubling about the temperature rising issue is that it seems like even though that a lot of data has been collected, they really can't come to any solid conclusions, you know, because they could, like you were saying, they could say, okay, the Earth is trending in a warmer direction, 1 or 2 degrees, and then you hear people arguing,
right.
Well, how accurate can we judge a average Earth temperature, and how much of a Herculean effort that is just to come up with some type of average number over a 1 year period, and, you know, there seems to not be enough information about it to even really say, is it happening?
Well, but again, like many complex sciences, there's always, you know, room for doubt. Just like when we had the conversation with Tara Smith about, you know, HIV causing AIDS, there's the same sort of complexity in that issue as well. There's lots of things we don't know about what HIV is actually doing and how it's actually causing AIDS. But that doesn't call into doubt the basic premise that AIDS is caused by the human immunodeficiency virus. And I think it's the same thing, in my opinion, that the basic idea that there is man-made global warming is not called into question by these things on the fringes that we don't know. But, you know, so I do see that some of the, again, the anti-global warming critics do use some denialist strategies in arguing against global warming. That's my perception based upon reading like some of the arguments of Steve Malloy and even some of the arguments that George Will echoed in his article. Saying, for example, that in the 1950s we believed that the Earth was cooling, and now we think it's warming. That's classic. That's like what creationists do, talking about the fossils that scientists got wrong 50 years ago. It's irrelevant to the consensus that has arisen 50 years later. That's a denialist strategy. So I think if the anti-global warming scientists want to be taken more seriously, they've got to clean up their rhetoric a little bit and not engage in some, you know, the conspiracy arguments that they're making and not engage in some of this denier strategy that they're using. That would be my advice for them. Not that they're wrong, I just think they need to clean up their strategy. But this is a topic I'm sure we will come back to, because this is not going to go away anytime soon. And it has very real and immediate implications for public policy. Let's go on to a lighter topic, a literally happier topic. NASA scientists have discovered a happy face on Mars. This was images that are being sent back by the latest Mars explorer. This is funny because these kind of things come back all the time, and it's helpful to put things like the face on Mars into perspective. So here you have a nice round crater. There are, you know, one crater for an eye, a series of smaller craters positioned to be the other eye, and a smiley face. And then, you know, again, a series of small either mountains or craters that make a smile. And it's, you know, it's in good enough position and proportion that it makes a very plausible smiley face. And it's obviously a natural formation.
So you're saying the aliens didn't build the smiley face?
Right, so no aliens need be invoked to explain the smiley face, which is the same thing as the face on Mars. You know, you look at the early images of the face on Mars, and it was half in shadow, and it was really just an eye and half of a mouth. Actually, a lot of the early pictures also contained what appears to be a nostril, but the nostril was an artifact added. It's like, you know,
it's missing data
added afterwards.
It's missing data.
Yeah, it wasn't an actual
feature.
Structure. It was just an absent pixel of data that just happened to be where the nostril would be. So that was completely artifactual. My favorite, though, have you guys seen the Kermit the Frog on Mars?
Yeah,
Kermit the Frog
great.
Is awesome. So obviously the ancient Martian aliens knew about Kermit. Maybe they worshipped him. Who knows?
Could have been.
Well, didn't they come down here and plant us here or something?
Yeah, a lot of people believe that. You know,
chariots or something.
There are. You know, a lot of these sort of UFO cult and pseudoscience belief systems built around the notion that humans were planted on Earth by our alien cousins, which is
all life or just humans?
Just humans.
Well, that's
which
ridiculous.
Is yeah, which is a problem. They would have had to have planted all life here, because humans share our genetic code with all other life on Earth, bacteria, peas, you know, petunias. So
yeast.
It's random. It would be an infinitesimal probability if it would happen by chance. Life that evolved on another planet would not have the same arbitrary genetic code that life on this Earth does. So if you believe that anything was planted here, you'd have to believe that all life was planted here. And, of course, that would contradict the evidence for evolution.
Plus, Steve, you know, think of it this way. They picked a smiley face and Kermit the Frog as the images that they want, you know, to make us be able to view with a telescope.
Well, they're happy guys.
Right.
Who would pick a smiley face and Kermit the Frog other than, like, a four-year-old?
I might. Granted, I would have gone with Gonzo. But.
The ancient Martian believers say that this is all a NASA conspiracy to sort of make fun of and discredit the Face on Mars believers.
Do we really need to make fun of them? Does NASA need to do that officially? Aren't they pretty much just making fun of themselves at this point?
Yeah, they do a pretty good job themselves.
You nailed it.
Well, with that, let's move on to some email questions. We actually received our first voicemail email.
Yay.
This is from Rich Ludwig from Hillsboro, West Virginia, and he responded to our request for people to send us to actually record their voice speaking their question. So let's play that now.
Hey guys at the Nest, I enjoy your podcast every week. I take every chance I can to spread the word about your show. I have two questions that I hope you could give me advice on. The first being about evolution. Where can I find good evolutionary information and reading? I'm a believer in evolution, yet I do not feel I can defend my position as well as I'd like. My limited background in evolution is in International Baccalaureate Biology 3-4 in high school, some time ago. I would like to do more research. Any recommendations as to books or websites would be greatly appreciated to further my knowledge about evolution. My second question is dealing with promoting critical thinking. I notice that skepticism deals mainly with bashing bad science. I was wondering why there isn't more promoting of good science. As I look through even your articles, few are about new discoveries such as Lucy or other findings. I'd like to see both on skeptical pages. Why is there not more?
Well, thank you, Rich, for sending in your voicemail. For the first question, you're absolutely right, and this is a good point, that believing in evolution and having a high schoolish sort of education about evolution really isn't enough to stand toe-to-toe with a well-prepared creationist. You have to know really a lot of details about evolutionary theory, and you have to know a lot about the argument styles of evolution deniers, of creationists and intelligent design proponents.
Namely, making stuff up as you go along.
Right. But they're good at it. They're very good at it. Their logical fallacies can often be quite subtle. In fact, they're my favorite textbook example of logical fallacies, because they make every single one that there is. They really do. But the sources that I've used that I think are good, on the web, I think that talkorigins.org, and of course this link will be on our notes page, is the best overall evolution site on the web, and also deals with creationism and intelligent design. So you'll see lots of resources, not just about evolution, but also about debating creationists.
Also, go to our logical fallacy page and read that until you're well versed in these fallacies, and you'll be amazed at how often you find them crop up in debates with people.
Then read creationist websites and just name all the logical fallacies. I cut my teeth, often, even when I was in high school and college, proselytizers would come to my door to preach whatever their fundamentalist religion was, and I would immediately spark up a conversation with them about creationism. If they didn't want to talk about that, I sent them packing. But if they wanted to have, I would talk to them for hours about evolution and creationism. Not that I thought I was going to change their mind, but just to hone my skills and just to learn what kind of arguments they make.
Another good way to do that is to hit up some online forums, because you'll find people there debating things like that. And not only do you get to see the arguments the creationists are using, but you have some time to take the information, process it, Google it, look into it before responding. You don't need to come up with something on the spot.
I looked at my bookshelf just to see what evolution books I have on there, and some of the ones that I have that I think are good. Wonderful Life by Stephen Jay Gould is a great discussion of some evolutionary thinking. The Pattern of Evolution by Niles Eldritch. of course, The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, and sometimes it's good.
That's a tough read.
It's a tough read, but you know what? It's worth going back to the source. I mean, get through some of those chapters if you can. It really is worth it. It's amazing to me, even now, how much of evolutionary theory Darwin got right at the beginning. He really spent decades working out a lot of the things, and a lot of his solutions to some of the scientific problems of evolution are still the solutions today that we invoke.
It's really, really brilliant. And when you think about coming from almost nothing, nowhere to conceive of and systematize evolution in his writing. Amazing.
It was an incredible intellectual achievement. Also, I have on my shelf Taking Wing by Pat Shipman, who I actually studied under at Johns Hopkins. She's an excellent evolutionary biologist. All about the evolution of flight, again, which is it's a topic which is frequently a target of creationists, and it is incredible how much we actually know about that. I also like reading about human evolution. The three books that I have on that are the Neanderthals, Lucy's Child, and the Hominid Gang. Although those are getting kind of dated, so there are probably some newer ones out there that would be worth reading. I probably need to update my library myself. So those are some resources, I think, that...
What about Sagan, Steve? Shadows?
Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors, you know, that's an interesting book. It's not really so much about evolution as about human psychology and what we might be able to learn about human psychology from examining our closest relatives, other primates, basically. Regarding the second question about promoting good science to balance our bashing of bad science, I mean, that definitely is a good point. And you know, this is a subject that we have talked about amongst ourselves as well, that we have to make sure that we promote how cool and wonderful real science is, and that, you know, often the media promotes pseudoscience and bad science because they think it's cool and sensational, but they're really, you know, cheating the public, because real science is far more interesting and far more bizarre and cool than anything in fiction.
Like
or science
Snipply
fiction.
The furry lobster?
Yeah, like Snipply the furry lobster, or black holes, or anything to do with quantum mechanics or cosmology. It's all really interesting, bizarre stuff. It's great. But we don't spend too much time just talking about ordinary science, because regular scientists do that, and there are plenty of other standard science outlets that do that. Our niche is skepticism. It is dealing with the fringe, the controversial science, the weird science, you know, pseudoscience. So we are going to always emphasize that, but we do need to balance it with, you know, promoting some good science. And I do think we try to do that on the Skeptic's Guide. Maybe we need to do a little more of that as well. But thanks again, Rich, for sending in your question. We got another email, again, coming back to the flood. So our listeners want to hear more about the flood. This one is from Huxley, who I believe has sent us at least one other email in the past. Thanks for writing again, Huxley. He writes, "When people claim the flood was responsible for the extinction of the dinosaurs, what do you tell them? Here are just a couple of websites that try to explain how the Bible talks about dinosaurs, how they lived with us thousands of years ago, and much more." He gives a couple of links, which we'll have on our notes page. "Please put to rest and air. Thanks, Huxley." Well, I wish I could put this to rest. I'm sure I can among, you know, rational thinking people. It's beyond my power to put this issue to rest forever, because, you know, you can't reason someone out of an opinion they didn't reason themselves into in the first place, right?
Good quote.
But it did bring up a point that I had thought about, and we didn't have a chance to really talk about it. So, you know, 2 weeks ago we talked about the satellite photos that some believe are of the Ark, which to me looked like just the edge of the mountain. Then last week we talked about, in response to a listener's email, how many animals could have fit on the Ark. And even by conservative estimates, there are just far too many animals in existence than you could have possibly squeezed onto the Ark. But the creationists who also believe in the Ark, you know, many of them claim that all extinct animals, all animals that are now extinct, including ones that, you know, scientists believe lived millions of years ago, well, they must have all been on the Ark too, because they must have all been contemporary of Noah. So, in fact, I've seen creationist, you know, books and literature that literally has pictures of baby dinosaurs on the Ark. So when we're doing our calculations of how many animals have to be on the ark, really we need to consider all of the extinct animals too, including all the dinosaurs. So that tremendously increases the burden, you know, that would have been placed on the ark and on, you know, poor Noah and his family.
Wouldn't it be easier for the creationists to just say that the dinosaurs drowned in the flood?
Yeah, I don't know why they. I guess I don't know why they don't say that, except for the fact that the Bible says that Noah had to collect all of the animals. And one of the links that Huxley provides talks about the fact that dinosaurs lived only a few centuries after the flood. And I thought about that too. Why not just kill them off in the flood? Wouldn't that make it easier?
If I were writing a book about creationism, I would have killed the dinosaurs off in the flood.
Right. That seems like the easier way to go. But I guess they didn't want they wanted to avoid any apparent conflict with the literal truth of the Bible. They also tried to make a case for dinosaurs and humans coexisting, being coeval, by saying that biblical descriptions of the behemoth are really Apatosaurus, and biblical descriptions of the Leviathan are really Kronosaurus, which is not a dinosaur, but a giant aquatic lizard contemporary to the dinosaurs, often compared to Godzilla. You know, it's a giant meat-eating aquatic lizard.
Neat.
And they you know, it's quite a stretch.
Now, was there
was
there a biblical equivalent to Mothra? I'm just wondering.
There should have been, though. I bet you could find some passage somewhere in Genesis that you could twist into Mothra just as believably as they twisted those descriptions.
I bet if I could do that, I would have a lot more people reading the Bible than currently do.
We have that. That's my challenge to you now, Rebecca. You need to find a biblical reference of some cheesy Japanese monster like Mothra or Gamera or whatever.
Done.
I'll leave it open. I'll give you an open field. It'd be any Chinese movie monster.
I will have it ready for next week.
All right,
and
there we go.
If I do, Jay has to eat 10 more pounds of bacon. How's
okay,
that?
Okay, it's a deal.
Excellent.
For those of you who follow the Sopranos, we heard about evolution this week on the show. With an evangelical on there, and he said that evolution was Satan's plan to destroy faith, I think.
Right,
he
also said that, you know, scientists have an agenda. Then that's why
that they have an agenda.
Yeah, like fundamentalists don't have an agenda. Here's our agenda, but don't believe scientists. They have an agenda. Okay.
Christopher also brought up the stupidity of it because he said T. Rex in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve would be running around scared shitless all the time, and the Bible says it was paradise.
Yeah, how could you have T. Rex in the Garden of Eden? Come on. I guess he was a gentle T. Rex. Back in paradise.
I guess before he was corrupted by
sin. He's like the T-Rex in Toy Story.
Yeah, right. I loved him.
I also got another email. Now, maybe this one came in just a few days late for April Fool's Day, but this one comes in from Roscoe, and Roscoe asks, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, Roscoe, that is definitely a burning scientific question that has vexed skeptics for centuries, really. But I believe, now, Rebecca, we were discussing this earlier before we recorded, and you felt that you had the answer to this question.
Yes. The egg. I mean,
the egg.
Yeah, the egg. Well, if you think about it in evolutionary terms, I mean, there was an egg. Eggs existed before chickens, right?
But did chicken eggs exist before chickens?
Well, that wasn't the question.
No. That's true.
Well, at some point, there was some mutation in this egg thing that just pushed it over the line and made
exactly.
it a chicken. Yeah, right? There was a creature that was almost a chicken that gave birth
right,
to
so
a
the egg
right.
came first.
So an almost chicken right. had to lay a chicken egg.
Yeah, if you were going to say which came first, right. an egg or an almost chicken, well, then I'd have to think.
But now,
about
hold
that,
on. But I follow your logic. But I found a press release dated today, April 12, 2006, from the University of Chicago Press Journals. And the title is Evolutionary Proof That the Chicken Came Before the Egg.
Oh, no.
So here we have an alternate hypothesis. Now, there's a slight variation of this. The actual title is Evolutionary Proof That, in parentheses, Eating the Chicken Came Before the Egg. And what this guy says is that animals that are carnivorous will, through evolution, will develop a taste for an animal and then later start eating that animal's eggs. So animals that ate chickens, you know, started eating the chickens and then developed a taste for eating the chicken eggs later. So when it comes to evolution and carnivores, the chicken comes before the egg.
That's very clever, but I'm still right.
Yeah, you are. But I was amazed. I was amazed that I found a press release that actually dealt with the chicken coming before the egg today.
It's kismet.
Coincidence? I think not. All right, let's do one more email. We got this one comes from Jeremy from Albany, New York. Jeremy writes, "Dear Skeptics Guide, I love the podcast and listen every week. I am a major skeptic and a science student in environmental science. One of the more common complaints against skeptics is that we reject everything out of hand, but I think the thing that's great about science and skepticism is it isn't rigid faith and that we have a standard of evidence that once met will cause us to change our minds." Absolutely agree. "I was wondering if you could devote a podcast, a webpage, or even direct me to a webpage that goes over the kinds of evidence that would be convincing. The best example I could think of is cryptozoologists found a specimen living or dead that was available for scientific study. I also think that if any of this stuff does exist, it might increase the likelihood of finding it if the believers know what to look for. I also think we, in the scientific and skeptical community, need to be clear about what we are looking for in terms of evidence." Well, he asks another question, but let's answer this one first. It's hard to answer that across the board with, you know, every science, because, you know, the reasonable threshold for evidence for believing any claim depends upon the claim. It depends upon the prior probability. It depends upon alternate hypotheses. So it really is kind of a moving target and a judgment call for each thing. But I will refer you to some articles that we published on our website that deal with that kind of question. One is a paper I wrote on denial and skepticism, which talks about having a reasonable threshold of evidence, and also like cautions skeptics against the out-of-hand dismissal. I specifically used UFOs as an example. You don't want to engage, even though we know that like aliens are not visiting the Earth. That's I think the scientific consensus, and we could, you know, confidently infer that from all the evidence. We still don't want to use that to justify making denialist sort of statements or dismissing evidence out of hand. We still have to give all the evidence a fair shake. So I'll refer you to those articles, and then with respect to other disciplines, it's basically an individual, you know, decision. He goes on to write, on a different note, "I saw a show that suggested that the psychosomatic effect is a possible explanation of stigmata. I don't think it is, but I am curious about the scientific consensus regarding the existence and nature of the psychosomatic effect. Can a penny really produce a blister in a hypnotized, suggestible person, or are these experiments flawed? If you could direct me to some of the scientific literature on this topic, I would appreciate it. Thank you for your time." Well, so the definition of a psychosomatic illness or psychosomatic symptom is one that is a physiological symptom which is caused by a psychological cause. So somebody has anxiety or stress and it manifests physically. That is well established, but you have to separate out the different kinds of symptoms that can be caused. So, for example, there are some symptoms which are directly a result of psychological stress, like high blood pressure can be caused by stress, and by extension, heart disease. So you can have psychosomatic, you know, physiological symptoms secondarily due to stress. There are many neurological symptoms can be caused by psychological illness.
But can you make your hands bleed? That's what I want to know. Isn't that what stigmata is all about?
I was going to get to that at the end, but I'll say the answer to that is no. I mean, you can't cause your skin to break down and blood to start pouring out of your hands or your wrists.
Darn it!
Because you will it to. I have seen shows that try to debunk the stigmata by citing that as a possible cause, but that's making it way too complicated, and that's also proposing a very unlikely mechanism to explain something that's much more simple. These people are simply cutting themselves, and they're doing it when no one's looking. I saw a show about a priest who claimed to have the stigmata, And the people described it as just appearing before their eyes. But the, on the video, that's not what happened at all. What happened was he moved his hand over his palm, and then when he moved it away, the stigmata was there. It didn't actually appear before your eyes. It appeared while it was being hidden by his other hand. And what this guy does is he has in the top, he has a ring on his finger, which he can, you know, he can expose sort of a sharp edge on it, and he just presses it against his skin and causes stigmata to appear. These things always occur on parts of the body that people can reach. People never have these kind of effects on parts of their body that they can't reach themselves, whether it's a rash or a stigmata. And it always happens out of view. It always happens in a context where it could have occurred simply by cutting the skin with your fingernail, with a ring, with something hidden. So we don't have to invoke psychosomatic effect to explain stigmata. But there are, you know, I'm a neurologist, and I have seen really profound psychosomatic presentations, like psychosomatic blindness, people who believe they can't see. And they really seem to believe that they can't see, but we can prove that they can see.
How do you prove it? Do you just throw something at them?
Well, you could do that. We actually do what's called a blink reflex, where you just flick your fingers in somebody's eyes. You have to be careful not to blow wind in their eyes, because then you'll get a blink response to the wind against their cornea. You get a corneal response. Mm-hmm. But if you just do a visual threat and they blink, that's a visual response. You can also do what's called optokinetic nystagmus. It's basically alternating bright and dark vertical strips, you know, vertical lines, and you move that across their visual field, and your eyes will involuntarily track the moving vertical lines. Hmm. And if your eyes do that, then your brain can see that strip, even though consciously you may be in denial about that.
Sorry, what do you think would happen if you threw something at somebody? Because from their point of view, they can't see, but their brain says they can. So
typically, when people have psychosomatic symptoms, they will still subtly protect themselves. Hmm. And that's one of the tricks that we use to figure it out. Let me give you another. So they probably would you know, raise their arm or duck.
Okay.
And then have some rationalization for why that happened.
Right.
They would have to be, I think, prepared and pretty dedicated to not duck. See, if people also have psychogenic weakness, they believe they're completely paralyzed in one arm, in both legs, or whatever. In fact, when they have complete and total weakness, they can't even flicker their muscles, that's often a sign that it's psychosomatic. Usually with neurological weakness, it's not 100%. It can be. It depends on the cause. But you need a pretty significant anatomical cause. But if your right arm were completely flaccidly weak, and I held it over your face while you were lying down on your back, say in a hospital bed, and I dropped your hand would fall right into your face and would hit you in the face. If you have psychosomatic weakness, the hand will still flop down, but it will just miss the face.
Right.
So they still will protect themselves if it's psychosomatic. So that is, but they don't have awareness that they're doing it, you know.
So Steve, is there such a thing as psychosomatic masochism? I mean, they would pass your tests, wouldn't they?
Not that I know
yeah,
of. Maybe if we find that, we can write a paper about it. Okay. What were you going to say, Rebecca?
I was just going to ask if you think that psychosomatic weakness is a good reason for calling out sick from work. it's a disease, right, of some sort?
Yeah, it's just a mental illness, not a neurological one. So it's kind of in that gray zone there. So it's, you know, psychosomatic symptoms can be very dramatic, but not stigmata, because that requires actual, you know, physical breaking down of the skin, and it's a lot easier to explain that with just simple tricks. Well, we have just enough time for science or fiction, so let's move on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Every week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are genuine and one is fictitious. Then I challenge my esteemed panel of skeptics to see if they could tell which one is the fake. Now, I'm on a roll. The last 2 weeks, I totally ran the table on you guys, because I got all of you for the last 2 weeks. So we'll see if you could break the trend. You ready?
Yep.
Bring it on.
All right. The loose theme this week is biology. These are all in the biological end of the spectrum. All right. Item number one. New research shows that younger siblings are smarter on average than their older siblings. Item number two. Scientists have discovered how to reverse the process of cell division. And item number three, researchers discover the quote-unquote strongest glue in the world produced by a river-dwelling bacteria.
Wow.
Perry, why don't you start us off?
Well, being an expert parent like I am, I would say that the first one can't think of any reason about why that should be so. The third one, I always heard it was barnacles that made the strongest glue, a bacteria. And what was the middle one?
Scientists have discovered how to reverse the process of cell division.
That would be kind of neat. That one sounds a little far-fetched. For no particular reason, I'll pick number three.
Okay.
I think that one's false.
All right, Jay?
Well, of course I'm going to go with number one, because I'm your younger sibling, and I am your intellectual superior.
Well, then you would think that that would be true, Jay.
I do. I totally agree with that.
Right, so which one's the fake one?
I'm agreeing with you. I'm telling you. I'm going with that one.
All right.
Steve, come on. The strongest, everybody knows the strongest glue in the world is made by barnacles. So I disagree with number three.
So you're going on the barnacle hypothesis. You're going to agree with Perry that the strongest glue in the world is fake.
Yes.
It's fiction. All right. Rebecca?
Gosh, you know, the last 2 weeks I went along with everybody else, and they were all wrong. So I feel like I need to zig. The second one seems so outrageous that seems like it would be huge. But I think I'm going to go with it, even though I really want to go with the first one because I am the youngest sibling. I don't think it's true. So
okay.
I'm going to go with number two.
You're saying number two is fiction?
Oh, wait.
Or is number one fiction?
Oh, wait. So only one is fiction. I just got totally confused.
Yeah, so number one is new research shows that younger siblings are smarter on average than their older siblings. So you think that that's fiction?
I think that's fiction, yeah.
Okay.
Because I'm not very bright.
So anecdotal evidence.
Yes.
So you're gonna forsake the argument from authority.
That's right.
And go with the anecdotal evidence. All
yes.
right, Bob.
Okay, younger siblings smarter. I mean, that sounds reasonable. I mean, which means it might be the actual answer. The glue from river bacteria, that sounds completely plausible. I mean, nothing that bacteria do surprise me. Their metabolisms are just so diverse. It does not surprise me at all that they would produce a super strong glue. The reverse mitosis, cell division, that sounds whacked. I can't imagine. Come on. It mean, with the DNA, it's going to split back up. And I got to go with that just out of principle. I'm probably wrong because it's too obvious. So I'm going with two.
Okay.
We're all over the board.
All right. Well, you're split. So I can't run the table on you this week because you split.
Ha.
So let's start. All right. We'll start with number three, since Jay and Perry both went with this one. Number three is science. Is true. Scientists have discovered a river dwelling bacteria that produces the strongest glue in the world. These bacteria use it to cling to the stuff so that they don't get, you know, flow down the river. So now the next step, of course, would be to figure out a way to mass produce it, which, right. You know, if bacteria create it, that shouldn't be a hard thing to do. Just make a bacteria crank out the stuff. And they actually think it might have some applications as a medical adhesive, you know, because, you know, bacteria use this to glue themselves to, like, leaves and other stuff. So maybe in a few years we'll be using bacterial glue.
Bacteria rock.
Bacteria are cool. They are cool.
I guess those scientists missed the Odd Couple episode where Felix Unger was trying to sell the barnacle
glue. Barnacle glue is old school, Jay. You gotta graduate to bacterial glue.
I think they're onto horse glue right now, aren't they?
I'm an old school guy. I like the old school stuff.
Who said number two is fiction? That was Bob.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So let's do number two. Scientists have discovered how to reverse the process of cell division. That is the most far out one of the three this week. It also happens to be true. That is science. This
wow.
is huge. This is a major breakthrough. Basically, you know, the process of cell division is, you know, one cell splits into two. Obviously, there are implications for aging. There are implications for cancer. There are implications
wow.
for regeneration. And what they actually figured out how to coerce a cell into stopping the process and in fact reversing it. But they after a certain point they can't do it. So there are still processes that are going on downstream that they haven't identified yet. Why this is huge is because it's teaching us a tremendous amount about the biochemical and genetic processes that the cells go through when they go through cell division. And learning about those processes will teach us about when it goes awry in lots of diseases, like, you know, the most prominent one, of course, is cancer, where cells divide inappropriately or without limits. So it's, you know, a basic science discovery. It's always hard to tell how it's going to apply clinically, but this is a major, huge advance. And
you recall who published the discovery?
Yeah, this was discovered. This was published. This is going to come out in this week's issue of Nature. You know, the most prestigious science journal.
Right.
The scientist is Gary Gorbsky, a scientist with the Oklahoma Medical Research Foundation.
Cool.
So it's from the U.S.
Yes. Published okay. in the April 13th issue of Nature. So
extremely impressive.
You're probably going to hear about this over the next week or two. I think this will start to go to the science news outlets. I mean, I picked it up on a press release. You know, it's going to be published in tomorrow's issue of Nature.
Well, Steve, that is pretty amazing, but I think we should focus on the fact that I'm totally right this week.
Yes, Rebecca got this one right. So,
and I got it right by trusting in my own stupidity. Yes.
I thought I would get Jay on this one. So new research shows that younger siblings are smarter on average than their older siblings is fiction. That's false. In fact, however, their old research does show that. There are some papers that were published that suggest that perhaps younger siblings do have a higher IQ on average than their older siblings. And younger siblings are precocious in many ways because they have their older siblings to learn from and to look up to. But now a new study, which published by Aaron Wickman, who's in the psychology department at the Ohio State University, shows no difference by birth order. So this contradicts a previously held notion that birth order did make a difference in intelligence. This shows no difference. So that one was fiction. So Rebecca, you got it this
Woo-hoo.
Week. Congratulations.
Thank
Yay.
You.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is all the time we have for this week.
Oh.
Rebecca, gentlemen, thanks again for joining me.
Thanks, Steve.
Good episode.
It's always fun.
Yeah, we'll see you all soon.
Until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is a production of the New England Skeptical Society. For information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.thenes.com. You can send us questions, comments, and suggestions to podcast@thenes.com. Theorem is performed by Kinetto and is used with permission.